Hey guys, I've got a great new company and product to share with you. Now I know that, like me, many of you are beard men. So let me tell you about the Luxurious Bastards Company. The owner is David, and his company makes some amazing products. But of course, the beard oil and butter is just amazing. All of David's oils are hand-mixed and made in small batches, hand-poured by David himself. Now this isn't a company that's run by some executive in a mansion, depending on a fancy marketing scheme. He's a beard man, just like us. The base oil list is impressive. Sweet almond oil, avocado oil, rice bran oil, hazelnut oil, hemp seed oil, apricot oil, castor oil, as well as sunflower seed oil, cold pressed grapeseed oil, jojoba oil, argan oil, vitamin E, and an amazing luxurious essential oil blend. Your beard has never smelled better. Right now, I am loving 1886 with a scent profile of dry Cuban tobacco leaf, tobacco blossoms, dry spices, tonka bean, fresh vanilla, cocoa, dried fruit, cedar wood, and sandalwood. It smells amazing, and your beard will thank you for it. David also has combs, brushes, scissors, even products for that special lady in your life. So head over to luxuriousbastardco.com and use coupon code American10 for 10% off each and every single order. That's coupon code American10 for 10% off each and every single order. Just go to www.luxuriousbastardco.com or follow the link in our show notes page and get started today. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Morswick.
Okay, so welcome back to the show. Before we get started, now I just want to make a quick announcement. After this episode airs, the show will be on hiatus for 2 months. This is going to allow me to get some of the World War II episodes written, but also just take a much-needed break. Now, you can expect our new episode to air sometime in September. With that said, thank you for your support, and let's get into today's show. For today, we are talking to Dr. Eli Merritt, a political historian at Vanderbilt University, where he researches the ethics of democracy, the interface of demagogues and democracy, and the founding principles of the United States. He is the editor of How to Save Democracy, Inspiration and Advice from 95 World Leaders, as well as of The Curse of Demagogues, Lessons Learned from the Presidency of Donald J. Trump. He's got a Substack, so I suggest you check it out. You can just Google it. It's American Commonwealth. Today, however, we are discussing his new book, Disunion Among Ourselves, A Political History of the American Revolution. And let me note that you can get that at Barnes & Noble, but also I've got a link in the show notes to take you over to Amazon, and you can have it just delivered to your front door. And with the 4th of July coming up just a few days after this airs, I think this is the perfect book for the summer. So welcome to the show, Dr. Merritt. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Sean. It's good to be with you.
Great, great. That's good. Let's just get into this. Now, tell us a little bit about the book overall and how did it come about?
The book, which you mentioned, is called Disunion Among Ourselves, The Perilous Politics of the American Revolution. It's a book that takes on some misunderstandings that we have about the founding period of the United States and more specifically, the American Revolution, which the 8 years of the American Revolution is the main through line or narrative of the book. And I think that dominant misunderstanding we have is we have a sense in retrospect of the inevitability of the formation of one United States, mm-hmm. when in fact the one United States was hardly inevitable. One thing that seemed inevitable to many people in the 1770s and 1780s is that one United States would be very difficult, if not impossible, to form. What seemed more natural was the formation of regional confederations. Mm-hmm. And they most naturally talked about New England as one regional confederation and the middle colonies or mid-Atlantic confederation, and then the southern colonies. And so the main thesis one finds in the book is something I call the survivalist interpretation. And that is that the dominant reason we formed one nation instead of more than one nation or confederations is that there was no bloodless alternative to the formation of one country. And what I mean to say there is if the founders had attempted to break apart the original 13 colonies, original 13 states, into separate confederations, they would have fallen into civil wars. They knew and understood they would immediately go into war, civil wars, about finances, commerce, including river commerce, and most significantly about land, borderlands, border wars over disputed boundaries, and also major war over the Trans-Appalachian West, which we did finally get awarded in the Treaty of Paris in 1783. Mm-hmm. So I call it a shotgun wedding. They had the guns of civil war pointing them inward. And then through that tremendous force and also the practice of civic virtue in politics, they achieved everything they did. And also they failed to achieve certain things as well, such as a plan for emancipating slaves. So that's the origins of that's the main sort of thematics of the book.
That's really great, and I like how you succinctly said that. It very much is what the whole book is about. Now, I always have a hard time when I do these interviews of getting to the latter parts of the book. It seems we run out of time, so I'm going to jump forward to chapter 18. I really like this one. It's titled "The Greatest Empire of the World." And you know something very interesting, at least I thought was interesting, something the listener may not know, and that's the British in the summer of 1782 were interested in perhaps finding a way for the American colonies to remain within the empire, perhaps as a dominion. Can you expand upon that?
Well, I think the most critical matter there, if you're looking specifically at the year 1782, before the negotiators in Paris, John Adams and Benjamin Franklin and John Jay, had successfully negotiated in favor of independence for all 13 colonies, there was some hope within the British that they could successfully restore at least some of the colonies. And there was a period just earlier than that in 1780 and 1781 where the British had control most of the southern colonies. There was great fear among the leaders of the 13 colonies that, or at least some of them, that there would be a forced truce or forced peace in Paris or London, whereby some of the southern colonies would be restored to the British Empire in return for independence for the other colonies. So, yes, I mean, if you think about it, the British had a hard time. I mean, the most lucrative aspect of the British Empire during the 18th century was the 13 British American colonies. So they only with great reluctance gave them up. And some historians, myself included, believe that the attempt to what led up to the War of 1812. So we're look at how much later that is, like 3 or 4 decades. The British were continuing to hope, I think quite in vain, in the War of 1812 that they might resecure some aspect of their original British colonies.
I think it lends to the argument as well that none of this was inevitable, right? There were all sorts of different paths. And I think sometimes when we teach the history of this period, or really any period, we kind of brush over some of that. And we get this kind of narrative, right, that it almost makes it seem like it was inevitable the way it ends, because we know the ending. But they didn't, and it could have gone any number of directions other than the one that it went in. So I think that's that chapter really brought those thoughts to my mind. Now, when we talk,
I think that's really, you're repeating it. I brought that up at the beginning. I think that's one of the most fundamental facts. I think it is a fact for us to begin to incorporate into our thinking about the founding of the United States. And I'll tell you, to further elucidate and add detail to that concept of the American government, the United States was not inevitable. Charles Thompson was a smart, thoughtful Pennsylvanian who was in the Continental Congress. He was the Secretary of the Congress from 1774 until the end of the Congress, when we finally got a new constitution and a new government in 1789. So Charles Thompson took notes. Was there every day, took notes on the debate, so he had to pay particular attention. Now, let me tell you what he predicted in 1783. So even before by the time we knew we were getting peace, here's what Charles Thompson predicted. He wrote a series of three letters to his wife, in which he said something, I'm paraphrasing now, but I believe that the prospects for this United States are gloomy. Uh-huh. And he said, here's what he thought was going to happen. He thought that calamities of some sort were going to lead to the breakup of the United States into at least three, if not four, separate confederations or nations. And he said the first was going to be that New England was not going to stay in the American Union for long. New England, as we know, was very unified. They were more similar than any of the other regional confederations or regional areas, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. He predicted that they were going to break away and that there was going to be a problem, and it was called the Hudson River. They were not going to rest until they had control, access, but probably entire control over the Hudson River. And the problem with the Hudson River, of course, is it is entirely in the state of New York. So The Hudson River, we got to remember this is the 18th century when water was everything, it was 50 miles from the border of New England. So that New York, when New England broke away, New York was going to have one of two choices. One, it was going to have to willingly join the New England Confederation, so that in fact that country was going to be a country of New England plus New York, or they were going to have to defend themselves in civil war and likely lose. So New York was going to become part of the New England Confederation by one means or the other, one peaceful and the other violent. So Thompson also said that there would be the formation of a middle confederacy. That's what he called it, in quotes, middle confederacy. It would form for self-defense, and he said it would have an interest in expanding westward to claim some of the lands that had been won in the Treaty of Paris, but it would encounter a deep problem, perhaps even worse than the Hudson River problem. It was going to encounter Virginia across the Appalachian Mountains. Virginia claimed all of the land from Kentucky north all the way to the Great Lakes, all the way to the border with Canada. So there was going to be civil war in the West as well, because Virginia was going to defend its territory. Mm-hmm. And now, so what was the third confederation that Thompson predicted? Fascinatingly, it was the Confederation of Virginia by itself. Virginia was already the largest colony, even if we just look at its land claims of the state of Virginia today, the land that's east of the Appalachian Mountains. But again, you almost doubled the size of the country with Virginia's claims to these. So Virginia was going to set up by itself. And he said it might even become a monarchy. I don't know. New England won't become a monarchy, but Virginia might. And so kind of in wrapping up Thompson's visions of the future of the United States in 1783, he said, I don't know what's going to happen with these three southern states beneath Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. Mm-hmm. He said, because especially we have a big problem here with South Carolina. He said that South Carolina was unique among the original 13 colonies in its hot-headedness and its irascibility. And he even said, again, 1783, he said, these South Carolinians are so hot-headed that they are going to have to be humbled by civil war before they will join in any confederation at all. Mm-hmm. These shadows of the future are quite remarkable, I think, when we really look carefully at them, and even in the founding period of the United States.
It's so interesting to see or to hear his predictions, you know, especially now, what, 220, 30 years, 40 years, whatever it's been. I'm a history teacher, not a math teacher, so I'm sure somebody out there will email me with the correct number of years. But it's so interesting to hear that and to look back and see some of his predictions were amazingly prescient. Now, for the listeners, just let me remind you, we're talking to Dr. Eli Merritt, and we're discussing his new book that has just come out, Disunion Amongst Ourselves, A Political History of the American Revolution. You can get it at Barnes & Noble, or I've got a link in the show notes page. It'll take you to Amazon, so you can check that out. Now, when we are talking about the founding, I think another thing that we brush over is the contentious nature, and we've kind of discussed that. So I'm gonna skip that a little bit, because that's a question I need to just throw out. We've gotten to that one, but you made a point to discuss the so-called Frankfurt Advice. Can you delve into the Frankfurt Advice? I'd be surprised that the average person has ever heard of that.
Sure. So right as the founders or the delegates to the Continental Congress were first coming together in 1774, again, just to kind of lay out the narrative history, the Boston Tea Party took place in 1773. And in reaction to that, the British Parliament passed four coercive or intolerable acts, which were obviously focused on Boston and Boston Harbor. And they were just frankly authoritarian in terms of the way they basically closed commerce and closed government to the citizens of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
So New Englanders ride together into Philadelphia, and they're stopped 5 or 10 miles outside in a small town called Frankfurt by a bunch of Philadelphians, Pennsylvania delegates who are all Philadelphians for the most part. They said, "Look, we gotta give you a heads up here. Don't go into that Congress mentioning the word independence, or it's going to really break us apart, because most of the middle colony and southern colony delegates are absolutely fine independence to be anathema." They further said that, you know, Virginia has a really high sense of itself, and you're going to need to award as much power within the Continental Congress to Virginia as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also going to be critical to unite the southern colonies with the war effort, which was then, of course, exclusively taking place in New England. So Adams later reflected upon this. This was John Adams took notes on this. So Adams is the one who mentioned the Frankfurt Advice. He took notes on it much later. And he said that, in fact, this Frankfurt Advice, which he succinctly described as "let Virginia be in the lead of everything," was a dominant sort of motivating factor throughout all the early history of our country. So he queried, you know, why is it that the first president of the Continental Congress, whose name was Peyton, why was he a Virginian? Because of this Frankfurt Advice to unite the very dissimilar northern and southern colonies. Why was a Virginian picked to write the Declaration of Independence? Why was a Virginian picked to be commander in chief? And on, in like manner, helps us to understand one of the reasons that Virginia and Virginians were given such pride of place and preeminence within the early government. Again, it was to unite the southern colonies to the northern colonies, more specifically the New England colonies, where the war was taking place. And for until roughly 1779, 1780 is where the war was entirely taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Frankfurt Advice. And again, he said it was followed very carefully for at least the first decades of the nation's history.
It makes me wonder, and it's kind of a what if, but what if just popped into my head. I wonder what if instead of Abraham Lincoln winning in 1860, what if it was a Virginian running as a Republican? If that, I don't even know if that would have been possible, but you know, it's just one of those weird what ifs, right? Like, who knows?
I think that's really intelligent. I mean, I think that type of people say, call these things counterfactuals, and some people dismiss them as counterfactuals, but I think that the best way to actually understand what happened is to just use our imagination to imagine that the other things that could have happened. So that's truly fascinating to me to think if, let's just say, Abraham Lincoln, however it had happened, was from Virginia, and that the Republican Party had a voice in Virginia, and a Virginian had been elected, what would the southern states have done at that point? Wow, fascinating. Sean, you're going to have me thinking about that. Certainly, we know one thing. I mean, I don't mean to be overconfident. Certainly, we know that Virginia would not have joined in the Southern Confederacy. I would say that with some confidence.
Yeah, I think that would have, and that might have changed the whole calculus for everyone.
You would have had a Virginia, a Republican Virginia, president-elect of the United States who became president, and then you almost certainly would have had Robert E. Lee as the commander-in-chief of the Union Army against the other southern colonies withdrawing, because you may or may not know that Lincoln and his staff literally begged Robert E. Lee to be the commander-in-chief of the Union Army. And from my understanding of it, I think it's something he gave some thought to, but in the end, he had to go with his place of birth.
Yeah, it's a fascinating mind game to play the what if and just wonder what if. Who knows? That's definitely a fascinating one to consider. Now, one of the things that I was surprised to learn, although I don't know if I should have been surprised, but it's the after hours of the Albany Congress in the mid 1750s. You know, the delegates were taking advantage of the situation, I guess you could say. They were involved in some land speculation. How did this happen during the War for Independence?
So I bring up and give the history of the Albany Congress, which took place in 1754, by way of providing backstory as to how truly difficult it was to unite the original colonies behind any enterprise whatsoever. And so Benjamin Franklin was the primary organizer of the Albany Congress in 1754. And at that point, obviously the point was not to unify the 13 colonies against the oppression of the British Empire or the British Parliament. The purpose in 1754 was to unite 13 colonies against aggression and warfare instigated by the French and by Native Americans who would be allied with the French. Mm-hmm. So it's a data point or a point of proof that demonstrates how incredibly difficult it was to unite the colonies and what was on their minds. None of the Southern colonies even came to the Albany Congress. They did not end up embracing any lasting constitution. And folks joked that some of the delegates who came to the Albany Congress, they really weren't paying too much attention to what was happening in the legislative hall. They were joining together to negotiate with themselves and with the Native Americans who were in the environs of Albany, negotiating land deals. So that tells you what was most, I guess what you'd say was most on each colony's mind and the delegates of the colonies was the absolute supremacy of their own colony, the lack of the need to give up any power whatsoever to any sort of centralized government or centralized union.
Yeah.
And then they wanted to make money on land and other business ventures. That was the American way.
Yep. Yep. Business is the business of America or something to quote. Is that Calvin Coolidge? I forget now. 1920s. Business of America is business. not much had changed. I don't know if it's changed much either since then. Now, you titled one chapter, A Fatal Issue to Our Union. What was that issue and how was it overcome?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Michael Sievers, the writer, producer, and creator of The Silver King's War, a podcast series about my father's Second World War as a B-26 bombardier. Stanley L. Silverfield, a first lieutenant in the United States Army Air Corps from Birmingham, Alabama, rode in the nose, the greenhouse of the famed Martin Marauder. You can find The Silver King's War wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, you know, sometimes, Sean, people think you write a book and you have every little bit memorized. That's the title of the chapter. I would actually have to guess right now to figure out what was the fatal issue to the Union. So that's, of course, in quotes. But I can tell you with certainty that the fatal issue to the Union from page one until the end and actually lasting all the way until the late 1850s, fatal issue to the Union was in fact disunion. So here's how the founders thought about things. And this is how and why I like to call the founding of the United States a shotgun wedding. So they feared a three-step chain reaction was going to really be the undoing of the American Union and everything they were fighting for in the War of Independence. And in that three-step chain reaction, the first thing that was going to happen within the Continental Congress is some combustible issue was going to emerge that they did not compromise on or ignore, one of the two. And that combustible issue could have been slavery. It could have been not pursuing the War of Independence for the Newfoundland fisheries, which were life and death to New England. It could have been sacrificing Virginia's Western land to end the war early. That would have led to the secession of Virginia for sure. So the idea was one or more states is going to secede from the Union, and then what will happen? So that was step one, one or more secede from the Union. Step two is they would then go on, by, I think, astute prediction, they would then go on to form separate confederations. And that's step two. But now we have to stop and think, well, that sounds horrible, doesn't it? Well, actually, disunion into separate confederations, although it sounds strange and catastrophic to us, if they could have done that successfully and peacefully, it is probably what they would have done. But it is the step three and the three-step chain reaction that was so anathema. Mm-hmm. And that was they were going to repeat. They were going to fall into civil wars over finances, continental finances, which were a complete mess in terms of who owed how much to whom at that point and who owed how much to the Congress. Commerce, and then again, most significantly, we've already reviewed the ways in which land questions and river questions were going to bring the founders to civil war. So the most fatal issue to the Union certainly was not just disunion, because why not? What's the matter with disunion? It's disunion leading to civil wars. That was the big struggle. And we'll talk at some point about the way that impacted the founders' decision to perpetuate slavery. I think that's important. It has a role to play in that question as well.
And that actually leads to my next question. So what was the founders' response to that, I guess you could say? Because it's you're right. You've got the first two steps don't necessarily have to be bad. But it's that third step, right?
It's that third step. I mean, when we talk about that third step of falling into civil war and after already fighting an imperial civil war, otherwise known as the War of Independence. Mm-hmm. But so if we translate that into, we can look at this interpretive lens, which again, I call the survivalist interpretation. It affected the decision-making of the founders in all their important decisions. There's really no exception. Yeah. And so in slavery, it was as fundamental as elsewhere. And so what happened there is, if we think of the three-step chain reaction, what would have happened if one of the northern, almost certainly one of the northern states, their contingency of delegates have come and said, hey, you know, we've given this great thought and we understand that if they wanted to play to Jefferson, we understand that the British Parliament, you know, implanted slavery within your colonies starting back in the early 17th century. It's maybe not necessarily your fault that you have this great density of slavery, but we've just decided that as part of this American Revolution, it's far too inconsistent with us. And in fact, Tom, with the words you wrote in the Declaration of Independence, so we are only going to unite with you if we can come up with an agreement to end the slave trade. And also, if we can come up with an agreement, at least for the gradual emancipation of slaves. And well, that sounds, you know, I'm trying to speak like a diplomatic person, like maybe New York James Duane or someone. But that was going to lead to the secession of South Carolina and perhaps other southern states. And so there you see how the effort by northern, even abolitionist minded northern delegates would have led to the three-step chain reaction, secession, leading to the formation of separate confederations. And then these separate confederations were not going to be able to, through acts of diplomacy, solve their problems. They were going to fight over finances, commerce, and land on the battlefield. So that is, it's the tragic outcome. In some ways, the Declaration of Independence also resulted from fears of disunion and civil war. The election of George Washington also emerged in part from fears of disunion and civil war. But of course, the most tragic and the most lasting in terms of painful legacy of our nation is the perpetuation of slavery by the founders. I'll quickly say for three reasons, not just the survivalist interpretation, but I've talked about three interpretations to explain why the founders perpetuated slavery. Mm-hmm. First is the white supremacist interpretation, which says that there was built-in sort of sense of hierarchical racism that compelled the founders to perpetuate slavery. I think that's true. And then there's the economic interpretation as to why the founders perpetuated slavery. And that is that both North and South, the South more certainly, but both North and South were intertwined in an economic system in which all benefited from slavery and the slave trade and the commerce that resulted from that. And then that's correct as well. And then the survivalist interpretation, which I introduce in the book, and I also do have a number of posts on my newsletter, Substack newsletter, American Commonwealth, about the survivalist interpretation. It all combines together to lead to they survived. I call it a devil's bargain. The founders had to choose, are we going to do something here to help emancipate slaves and in the slave trade? Are we going to do that? Or are we going to save ourselves from civil wars? And in the end, they saved themselves from civil wars and sacrificed their rights and privileges and lives of enslaved people. So I call that a devil's bargain. In the end, they executed or perpetuated a devil's bargain. And that's why they perpetuated slavery and came up with no solutions for it.
Sad to say that they were not able to overcome that because, wow, they overcame so much, but it was that last one. They just couldn't come up with a way that, and that's too bad because, gosh, millions of people would have been better off if they could have just figured some way out. But
Yeah, and again, I definitely believe in complex history, and I do also believe that if we'll embrace the concept of complex history instead of simplistic or dualistic history, it really is a great help to us in terms of maturing our minds as human beings and also maturing our minds as a society.
amen.
So various interpretations can be acceptable
At the same time.
and true at the same time, right?
That's correct. And that's what I love about this book. It embraces the complexities of history. It doesn't present a cartoon version. So if y'all are looking for a great 4th of July summer read, and you're into this time period, even if you're not, I suggest you pick up this book either at your local bookstore. Just go to the show notes page and you can get Amazon to deliver it right to your doorstep. The book is Disunion Among Ourselves, A Political History of the American Revolution, written by Eli Merritt, who we've been talking to today for the last 30 minutes or so. And I thank you for joining me on the show, and I wish you the best of luck with the book. I'm going to be checking out your Substack.
All right, Sean. No, that's great. If people are curious, I'm happy to dialogue further with folks on my newsletter. It comes out about 3 times a month, and I learn a lot from feedback. So I encourage folks if there's no cost at all to it. American Commonwealth on Substack. If you search my name plus if you search Eli Merritt, American Commonwealth, I do believe it will come up immediately.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Eli, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, Sean. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so that's it for today, guys. Like I said, the show will be on hiatus for a couple of months. The next episode you get will be a World War II episode, in dealing with World War II in China. That is coming out probably in mid-September. So I will see you all next time. Bye-bye. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.